Good morning and welcome to our Market Outlook podcast. I'm Mark Binder, financial advisor on the Wise River Advisors team at UBS Financial Services. I'm joined by my team member, Craig Shiat. We are located in Los Angeles, California, and we can be reached at 310-734-2383. Today, my guest is Dave McGarrell, Chief Investment Officer of First Trust. Dave is not affiliated with UBS, and his views are solely his own. Today, we're being joined by David McGarrell, who is the Chief Investment Officer, Chief Operating Officer of First Trust. First Trust is a firm that we've worked with for many, many years. We have a great deal of respect for. And we've heard David many times speak about the macroeconomy. And what we wanted to do today is to have David share his view of the economy, markets, interest rates, and where he sees things going in 2024. So David, with that, if you could just start forward with our clients and give us your view on where we were last year and where you think we're heading this year.
Sure. Thanks, Mark. And good morning, everybody. Good early afternoon for me here in Chicago. I hope your weather is better than mine. It would be hard to believe it isn't. But I'll share our outlook, but it's really not so much our opinion of what is about to take place, but more the data and the guidance that we get from the data to position assets where we think can be attractive in an environment that, if we've known anything the last couple of years, the unknowns and the dynamism of what's happening in the U.S. economy constantly surprises us. And I think we can just look back over the last 2 years and see the input and the imprint on the Federal Reserve and the interest rates on the market. And I would say it has been absolutely massive and almost, I would say, 80% of the story of what happened to the equity markets the last 2 years. First in 2022, when the markets fell 18% in 2022. And there's an old saying in fixed income land that the Fed takes the stairs up when they're raising interest rates. They go slowly and they take the elevator down, that when they break something, they're going to cut rates massively fast in order to get the economy back where it should be and out of a recession. And I would argue in 2022, what the Fed did is they took the elevator up. They raised rates from May of 22, when they raised 50 basis points, to December of 22, when they raised another 50 basis points. But in between, they raised four times at 75 basis points per turn. So in just 9 months, they raised 400 basis points. Rates went up 4% in from May until December of 2022, and shocked the economy and caused the market to look forward and say, boy, we're going to have a tough time absorbing higher mortgage rates, higher cost of capital. We saw Silicon Valley Bank fail last year because of those higher rates and the low rates that they had in their book of business, which all of a sudden were worth a lot less when you can lend at much higher rates. And it did cause some damage, but it with only four rate cuts last year, all before July 31st, and all only at 25 basis points, so only a 1% increase, the market started to see the end of the Fed hiking rates and now expects them not to take the elevator down because things are good, but not too hot. And they expect the Fed to just cut rates maybe two, three, four, five times this year. We're at 5.5%. That's why money markets still pay 5% in the short run. But longer term, if you look at the 10-year treasury, it sits closer to 4.1%, indicating that the market does believe that the Federal Reserve is going to cut rates. And that's why long-term rates would be lower today than short-term rates on the prospect that the Fed will cut interest rates. Regardless of where the Fed ends up this year, we don't really think it matters that much if it's two times or three times or four times. Remember, we went from 0% at the end of 2021 on interest rates to 5.5%. That's a 550% increase. If the Fed cuts four times this year, 1%, 25 basis points per time, then the Fed would have cut interest rates from 5.5% to 4.5%, which is an 18% decline. Corporate activity, capital projects will not be that affected by an 18% decline in interest rates. It'll be helpful, but it will not be an indication that the economy is in big trouble and going into a massive recession if the Fed cuts two, three, or four times. Again, regardless, the impact of the Fed this year and the focus on the Fed, while still important, certainly in the election year, and they'll be torn within the political environment as well to cut interest rates. But we believe that they'll have a much less impact on both rates and fixed income, but especially equity markets. It won't be the only thing the market is focused on this year when it comes to stocks in 2024. Now, what happened late last year when the market did presume that inflation was not going to be as sticky as feared and was coming down, and the data today fortified that. The data the last several months has shown inflation getting lower as we've moved along the last 5 or 6 months or so. But that really happened in late October when the indication was that the Fed was not going to raise rates anymore. And we had what we call a Santa Claus rally in November, December. And that meant the S&P 500, 500 biggest stocks in the U.S. market, was up about 11% in the first 10 months of the year through Halloween night. And then it rallied another 15% in just 2 months in November, December to finish last year up 26%. Small cap stocks were down about 4.5% in the first 10 months, and they went up 22% in November, December and finished year up 17%. So it's still a better year for large cap growth stocks than for small cap stocks, but everything happened in the last 2 months of last year. And this year, we're up about 3% on the S&P 500. So we've seen that rally continue and we're at all-time highs. But what's important to us to remember is that what happened in November, December, priced in a lot of data that the market expects to come as we move throughout this year. And it better come because of what prices we put on top of a lot of the equity markets today. And that means that the 4.1% 10-year treasury is baked into equity prices today. The fact that the Fed will not raise interest rates and may cut several times this year, as early as March, but even July is fine, as long as they cut interest rates and not increase them, is also put into equity markets. And the last piece is earnings. And last year, from 2022 to 23, earnings fell, but fell much less than was expected at the beginning of the year, only about 2% or so. This year, the expectation is for earnings to grow about 11% from last year. So the market has baked in at least that those three factors, that treasury yields will not move significantly higher, that the Fed will cut short-term interest rates that they can control, those money market rates, which would suggest that perhaps investors will want to buy some of the longer dated maturities in fixed income to lock in rates at 4, 4.5, 5% now, since if you're just in a money market fund, you will actually see rates go lower immediately as the Fed does cut those interest rates. And also has imputed that earnings will not be flat or down, but actually will grow a little bit. So to significantly move higher from here, stocks will have to do, or the economy and earnings will have to be better than expected. The good news in our view is that the market is so bifurcated, and where you live, you know it, because it has been all about the Magnificent Seven, those stocks from Apple to Tesla, the seven biggest companies in the S&P 500 have dominated in 2023 to a massive extent. Now, it was really just recapturing a lot of the losses that they took when they got smashed in 2022. So the technology sector, the discretionary sector, where you have Tesla and Amazon, and the communication services sector in the S&P 500, where you have Google and Meta, took the brunt of the 18% decline in 2022, but they provided most of the firepower to see that 26% gain last year, and now we're at all-time highs, really on the backs of those seven companies. They're massive companies. Two of them, Microsoft and Apple, are worth more than $3 trillion today. As we sit here, never before have we seen companies with that kind of valuation, especially compared to the rest of the market. But those seven companies make up 28% of the S&P 500. So if we add up the value of those seven companies in a market that has a total value of all 500, about $40 trillion, again, 28% or a little bit more than $11 trillion is just in those seven companies called the Magnificent Seven today. So the rest of the market is the other 70% of the market or so. But the difference is what we really put on top of those Magnificent Seven last year is much higher multiples of their earnings going forward on this prospect that they will keep growing as fast as they have over the last decade. We think there's an opportunity to go a lot wider in the market. That's what happened in November, December during that Santa Claus rally. That's why small caps went up so much more than even large caps, up 22% in 2 months. Large caps only went up 15%, because there's a lot more room for those companies because of where they're valued to actually move higher, especially if their cost of capital, because of lower interest rates, it's more expensive for smaller companies to get debt financing, and lower rates will help them more and help their earnings more. And also, when you look at the earnings picture for this year, it is actually not dominated just by those seven companies or not dominated just by technology. Technology is still expected to grow faster than the 11% earnings growth, but healthcare is actually expected to grow the fastest. Communication services expected to grow third best after technology being the second best sector. So if we have 11% earnings growth expected this year, 18% is the growth expected in healthcare, 17% in tech, and then 16% in communication services. And then even financials and industrials are at 8 or 9%. But think about paying 27 times for the technology basket of future earnings, but only about 10 or 11 times for financials. So all of a sudden, when you see earnings growth in financials or in energy or in industrials, and you're paying so much less as rates come lower, those look like more attractive propositions for outsized gains when you do see the Mag 7, as great as those companies are, hitting your head on the ceiling based upon any historical valuation context. Those seven traded 35 times earnings. The market is closer to 21 times this year's forward earnings of the S&P 500 earnings projection. So the average is 21 times, but what makes that average so high is that 28% of the market, those seven names, are trading closer to 35 times earnings. So without those, the market is actually trading close to 18 times if we get rid of those top seven companies. So our advice is not to get rid of those companies, but not to put 28% of your portfolio on the equity sleeve inside of just seven companies that are very fully valued, even if they are some of the best companies in the world. So when we look forward this year, our outlook is let's focus on the Federal Reserve. They'll do their thing, but we expect interest rates to sit around this 4% number on the 10-year treasury, with short interest rates starting to move money out of money markets into longer fixed income maturities or into the equity markets. Valuation and earnings dominating the equity picture, as opposed to stocks falling very hard because rates were going up in 22, stocks recovering all those losses in 23, and then starting anew here in 2024. So we like a much broader set of companies inside portfolios versus a heavy concentration that we saw work so well last year. So Mark, I'm going to give this back to you for any questions or anything that you might want me to add to that commentary.
One quick question for you, which I would say at the beginning of last year, most people, including us, thought we would see either a recession or a slowdown during 2023. We just got the GDP numbers up 3.3% for the fourth quarter of last year, over 5% in the third quarter. My question is, you know, with monetary policy being restrictive, you know, which, you know, 5.25 to 5.5 Fed funds rate, the Federal Reserve over a period of time now over the last year, taking M2 money supply out of the economy, what's driving growth? And as you look forward this year, what are the risks to that growth? And what do you see in terms of either an economic slowdown, slight recession? You know, what is propelling, whether it's consumer spending, government spending, what's propelling the economy to grow the way it has? And do you think that that, you know, has legs and that will carry us through to either a soft landing or no landing, where we're just going to sort of be able to lower rates into a growing economy and have a, you know, a perpetual or another year or two of good, solid growth?
Sure. So I think the simple premise that I always think of is, and we take it for granted because of where we live, in the greatest country in the world, we have the most diverse economy in the world. We are in first place when it comes to technology, and then we're in second through 10th place when it comes to technology across the world. We dominate the technology space, which is a long-term secular story of our lifetimes. And it also creates a massive amount of productivity. And then couple that with the kind of the America experience of what we've been able to accomplish and what we tackle every issue, not with a plum every single time, not with a bunch of rhetoric, but the productivity of American business is just absolutely unprecedented. And whether it's, you know, we get ships stuck in the Panama Canal, we get gigantic oil spills, everything hits us, massive supply chains, we can't get barges onto the shores in LA at the ports, and then we always figure it out. And that's really what happened is every time we're faced with a challenge collectively based upon, you know, individual companies and entities, we find ways to power through and tackle that. On top of it, we sit at an unemployment rate that I've never seen it much lower than in the mid threes where we are today. So if it's never been lower, I'm 57 years old, in the mid threes, I almost think the mid threes are almost like zero. Like if we're never going to be lower than that, then there can't be that many people if we always have 3.5% unemployment when things are when we're at as full of employment and there's help wanted signs throughout the economy. So we have, when you have a job, you can make your payments. You might not be flush, but you can do things, whether that's make minimum credit card payments, make mortgage payments, make rent payments, and there are jobs aplenty still in the market here. You are absolutely correct, Mark. We are not, the Fed is more restrictive than they were, obviously, when they were zero interest rates, and it's much less accommodative, so a little bit more headwinds than all the tailwinds of all that fiscal and monetary stimulus. But when you have this kind of employment, and when you have companies that have massive profitability the last several years, they're able to have a situation on their balance sheets when they look at their capabilities of not only paying their dividends, but having a lot of excess capital to say, where can I invest this by buying back stock, by raising my dividend, by paying down debt? I mean, you compare where we are today and the potential that there still could be a recession, we could see a slowdown, and take us all the way back to 08, 09, when we had the great financial crisis. And everybody on this call has a balance sheet that is markedly better than 08, 09. Because then leverage was considered okay. Housing prices were exorbitant. And everybody was overhoused and overlevered. And corporations were massively overlevered. And today, when you anticipate a recession for a couple of years, you make sure your balance sheet's in order and that when it hits, you're able to combat it. So nobody's going to be surprised if we have a modest slowdown. The market, I think, if it does not grow earnings 11% has enough firepower inside of it and quality balance sheets where we won't see a large decline. If we do see what no one's predicting, but could happen, anything could always happen, a much more difficult recession, unemployment goes to 6%, we will see equity markets get hit, but we will also see the Federal Reserve take the elevator down and start cutting rates massively, especially in a political year where we have a presidential election. So the market is set up this year, when you add everything up, to move higher, even though valuations don't suggest that we're going to go to the moon here because of the starting point after that big rally in November and December.
You mentioned it's a political year. One of the top questions we get from clients is, what impact will the election itself have on financial markets? And how do you see the outlook changing if it is either a Biden presidency or a Trump presidency?
Yeah, I think we always overshoot on this. I think everybody does. I think there's more emotion in the argument than actual data. And the data suggests, that it doesn't matter as much who wins from an equity market perspective. There's not a CEO in the land who is saying that she's going to do things markedly different based upon what happens in November. They have their plan of how they're going to grow their business. And in very few instances, except in the most regulated areas of the market, are they totally fixated on the results in November. I think it's always best for the market if we do have a divided government, so meaning the Senate, the House, and the presidency, at least one of those are in the other party, because it puts the government less fully involved in the economy, because things can get stopped if one party or the other really wants to promote an agenda that is where the economy ends up in second place to that agenda. So again, a split government, in my view, is always better, but way too much ahead of time put on who's going to win the election from a stock market or an economic. You're still going to have a Federal Reserve that's going to promote low unemployment and low inflation, regardless who wins the election and who is nominated, but not completely controlled by whoever the president of the United States is.
Related to that same topic are the budget deficit and the national debt, which is, now surpassed $34 trillion. We've always viewed that as a long-term problem that is hard to overly address in the short and intermediate term from an investment perspective. But we would like to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, it's another thing. And again, I mentioned I'm 57 years old. I've worried about the national debt for a long time. I got out of school in 88, and I remember talking about this in the 90s. And it's disheartening, to say the least. I mean, what we've added to the national debt over the last 10 or 15 years is absolutely insane, tens of trillions of dollars. I mean, it's nothing compared to what I worried about several decades ago. The deficit is even more alarming. Our chief economist and our senior economists call this past year the most egregious deficit in U.S. history in a year where we did not have a military conflict on our shores or where the U.S. wasn't directly involved. We have the most egregious deficit of a couple trillion dollars with an unemployment rate that's below 4%, an economy that grew 3%. That is just unprecedented and frankly needs to change, no question about it. But to stop the market, we still have a government that has the full ability to tax and drive more revenue through taxes. We believe that would come with slower growth longer term. In the short run, it raises a lot of revenue. Perhaps we'll see some increase in taxes, and hopefully what we see is some freeze or decline in spending, or at least stopping the increasing deficit that we've seen the last several years. But Brian Westbridge, our chief economist, $34 trillion is a ridiculous dollar amount when you think about our national debt. But one thing always strikes me, and he's as disheartened as I am about the government spending and the government's input and imprint on the economy. Certainly we all believe, or at least he and I believe, that the private sector is what drives wealth and productivity and better lives. And the government should have a role, but not the large role that they have today. But he said one time to me, he goes, well, if you really think about it, what's Manhattan worth? You had to pay for Manhattan. If you had to build Manhattan, if you had to build Los Angeles today, what's it worth? And you think about Apple's worth $3 trillion. Microsoft's worth $3 trillion. They certainly have cash flows. But Manhattan, New York City, what's that worth? So the assets of our country and the assets in, there's $8.8 trillion in money market and CDs today. The S&P 500 is worth $40 trillion. So it's almost unfortunate that we can handle this kind of debt and this kind of deficit as long as we have the currency of the world, the U.S. dollar, we have the productivity, and we have the best set of corporations in the world, bar none, where India is the fourth largest stock market in the world. It's worth $4 trillion when you add up all those companies. And just our top 500 companies are worth $40 trillion. And then you take our country and all the assets. Our CEO, Jim Bowen, says we have 23% of all the world's most precious commodity, fresh water, just in the Great Lakes. India and China would love to have that kind of fresh water. We have the most oil, absent Saudi Arabia, in the world, just on our shores. So we have so many natural assets and then so many compelling infrastructures, the ports in LA, the airports that we have. So we have an enormous set of wealth that allows us to absorb that $34 trillion. And the best evidence of that is we have almost full employment today. We have a stock market that's doing fantastic. And we have the ability for the Fed to say we can actually cut rates and people will still buy our bonds because of the strength and the vitality of, again, the most diverse economy in the world. So we just have, I feel like politicians take it for granted and are able to almost abuse on both sides of the aisle the wealth of this country and the spirit of the U.S.
So David, one more quick question for you, and then we'll wrap up. But you definitely seem relatively optimistic, hearing that you believe that markets are poised to move higher for a number of different reasons that you've expressed here on the call. But when you think about sort of what are the risks to that, the things that might keep you up at night, the things that you're looking at saying, this is a potential risk to that growth scenario. What are the things that you're looking at that might suggest, okay, if this happens, it could derail that projection? Or what are the things that you're concerned about with regard to the growth outlook that you've outlined here?
Sure. So I think there's all kinds of things that can cause a recession. Certainly there's geopolitical risk. We all know about that. The Fed can make a big mistake. They can keep rates too high and be too late to cut rates and not really see signals that the economy is slowing much more rapidly than expected, just like they missed the fact that inflation was coming much faster than expected and they were much too slow in raising interest rates, because we do have a higher set of prices today. Just because inflation is slowed down and is only growing at 3% doesn't mean we get to go back to 2019 and pay a dollar for that loaf of bread. Everything's $1.19 now. That was a dollar back then because of all that inflation. So that doesn't go away and certainly is an impediment to some future growth, you know, with the inflation that's already come about. And from an equity standpoint, you also have valuation. I mean, valuation, as I said, is not cheap. We put a lot into the market when we were up 10% in 10 months, and then we went up another 15% in 2 months. And we're up 3% in the first 24 days of 2024 here. So, you know, we're trading at 20 times earnings in the S&P 500. The long-term average is 18.3 over 25 years. About 16 and a half times is the 50-year average on earnings. So there's not a situation where we're going to go back and say, we don't believe we're going to see another 26% return in the equity markets, because we're not going to see 26% profit growth. And we shouldn't pay so much more for equities. But we do see, I mentioned we have all the technology, great technology companies in the world, bar none. Okay. Exxon is the best energy company in the world. They're going to make $40 billion over the last year, and they have a pristine balance sheet and a lot of growth and a ton of cash flow. Our healthcare companies, Pfizer, Merck, Johnson & Johnson, we have the best companies there. So we have just so many great entities here. And a lot of the companies I just mentioned are non-tech companies, but they're the best in the world. And those companies trade at 10, 12, 14, 16, 18 times earnings. So I think you can still have your technology footprint. 27% of the market is technology, but you can find better returns in the rest of the market. So valuation is a story, but it's really highly concentrated where you see the most highly valued companies, and they're great companies, but the opportunity for gains exists in a much wider basket, I think. So valuation, geopolitical events, the Fed, they can all, you know, hamper us in the market moving forward. But rates at these levels, and certainly inflation rates ahead, again, the Fed having to raise interest rates, the market will get wrecked if that were to happen and come down significantly from where it is today. If inflation comes back in, you know, April, May, and June, and the Fed says, oh, we might have to raise, then we'll see the equity markets really take it on the chin if that were the case. So those are the real threats that could happen. I don't think it's really a political event that could rock the market for any more than, you know, a couple of days if things are going where the market doesn't perceive it to be going.
Craig, do you have anything else?
I don't. We, David, really appreciate your counsel, you know, over the years as we've been in touch, and you spending the time today to speak to us and allow our clients to participate as well.
Great. Thanks, Craig. Thanks, Mark. You guys enjoy your day and enjoy the weekend. Thanks so much.
Perfect. Thanks.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.